And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
This work, these podcasts, our articles, our books, our videos, our workshops, all of this work that we do is, in a sense, based on helping people one at a time. Now, the reality is I'm no longer an investment advisor, so I'm not really helping people one at a time. But the effort is to share information for first-time investors and those midway towards retirement and those in retirement and those trying to do something for a child or a grandchild, just all sorts of different recommendations in the hopes that we'll be able to find a fit our information with your need. And once in a while, I have a chance to talk with somebody that I feel like, okay, if I could be there to make the pitch to the trustees of a 401k or a 403b plan, if I could try to convince them that index funds would be a better way to go. And yet, boy, I will tell you, in so much of our lives, the people who surround us just don't share the same beliefs and passions that we do. I mean, when I find out that somebody is paying high expenses and that they're likely to pay those expenses for the rest of their life, it really, truly does bug me and irritate me, and I want to figure out some way to do that. Well, some years ago, I talked with a fellow on the phone who was with an organization that a whole bunch of people were stuck with funds that had high expenses, actively managed. They didn't have target date funds. They didn't have index funds, all the things that we're trying to get people to do. And I just happened to be looking through emails. From time to time, I just sit back and look at old emails to see if there's something in there that I need to follow up on. And by golly, I did. I followed up on one, and I asked how things were going and whether this particular person had made any headway. And I'd always believed he had a true commitment to trying to help others. And now I hadn't heard from him for years, and I get an email back that says, thanks for your response. It looks like the 401k committee is adding 8 to 9 Vanguard index funds, covering most of the major asset classes that we recommend, including target date funds, and get this, a DFA small cap value fund. So they'll be able, if they wish, to put a small cap value and a DFA small cap value together with a target date fund. I don't know. I assume it's a Vanguard target date fund. It doesn't say that, but the fact that they say that they've added 8 to 9 Vanguard index funds suggest that those are Vanguard target date funds. He says this has been a 4-year effort to try to educate the committee on the importance of index funds with low expenses. What seemed to move the decision in favor of adding index funds was when I explained the wisdom of target date index funds. By the way, he didn't say that he used our video on target date funds to do that, but that's thrilling to know that there was that educational leverage there. It seemed to make sense to the committee, and they felt it would be helpful in giving a good starting option to those in the 401k plan who are not educated in the ways to invest prudently for retirement. Now, think about that. These trustees are agreeing that, yes, it probably is a good idea to make these target date funds available to young people. You know something? I suspect if we looked carefully, a lot of those old-timers could use a target date fund rather than what they're doing. But I'm not there to make that judgment. He goes on, I guess your passion for investing according to academic research for the long term, low cost, diversification, and proper asset allocation rubbed off on me, and I could not stay silent any longer. Yes, 4 years is a long time, but it will be worth it for my fellow workers for many years to come. Thanks again for your help. Wishing you and your family a wonderful 2020. Am I glad I emailed this gentleman and had a chance to find out the rest of the story. And of course, I never know that these things are going on unless somebody continues to pepper me with questions about the topic. But I am elated that we are helping to change the lives of a whole bunch of people. And what I'm going to ask this fellow to do is, when our new book comes out in a few months on the $12 million investment decisions and on target date funds, it's such a simple read, short read, but my hope is that book will become something that everybody who's in that 401k plan will have access to. Before I take what I think is probably one of the most delicate topics I've talked about here on our podcast in a few minutes, but before I get into that, I want to note something I found kind of interesting, and it relates to this email I just read. We put out a report, you might have seen, the nine decades the assets, small-cap value, large-cap value, small-cap blend, large-cap blend, and then the combination of the four. And those results were without any expenses. And Daryl Balls and I talked about that, and we decided to take a look at what these things look like after expenses. And it was very interesting. What Daryl used for small cap value, and I'm just going to do this one, is used a 15/100 of 1% expense ratio. Now, the fact is that there are small cap value funds that have expense ratios of over 1%. This just happens to be the ETF that Chris Pederson has selected in our best-in-class ETFs. So what Daryl did was he applied that 15/100 of 1% to the long-term track record of small-cap value. Now, without that 15/100 of 1%, the $100 grows to about $10,420,000. Now, you may say it doesn't make any sense to talk about what happened over 90 years. And by the way, the next 90 years is certainly not going to be the same as the last 90. But look at the impact of 15/100 of 1%. Instead of $10.4 million, it's $9.1 million. And who could that actually happen to? Remember, we're talking about a $100 investment. Is it possible that somebody could put $100 in a small cap value fund? You could do that at Fidelity. They've got one that's got no commission to get in, no minimum, and their expense ratio isn't 15/100 of 1%. It is 5/100 of 1%. So expenses really do count a lot. And of course, the longer you've got that compounding, this is that magic of compounding, but there is over $1 million difference on a $100 investment over 90 years. And that is not chump change. So I want to address a topic that I'm a little uncomfortable, but I've been asked, and I set myself up for this because I've brought a topic up several times when I talk about how unknown the future is. And in fact, as I thought about it, because this story has to do with what happened in my life, but when I thought about this, the fact that I happen to have the good fortune of having invested $15,000 into something that produced over 30 years, over a 30% compound rate of return. Now, I've said I have no idea how to tell people to do this on their own. I happen to know that lots of people have done what I've done and a heck of a lot more. Bill Gates has. A lot of people have. It isn't as big a deal as it seems, because when you take more risk, it's not impossible to have it pay a higher rate of return. And when I thought about this more and more and sharing this story with you, I thought about getting out my high school picture and then having it be right there next to my picture that was taken probably in the last 5 years sometimes, and look at those two people, that little got a crew cut, one of those crew cuts you put wax on it, you know, to keep it up when you were a kid. That was back in the 50s, late 50s, 61, I guess. I actually graduated from high school, but that's who I was. I didn't know anything of significance, except I was taught that we should treat people fairly and be nice to them and all those kind of things that have to do with what you hope you can instill in your kids character-wise and maybe even integrity-wise. I had some of that training, but in terms of really knowing something, I didn't know nothing, as John Pogel has said. So then I look at this old weathered guy that's got some hair left and lots of wrinkles and certainly overweight but a lot of experience. A lot of things happened in my life, and all of those things led to who I have been and what has happened to me and how much money I've made on the investments, particularly if they're investments that I could do something about. And this investment that I could do something about was this $15,000. I was 40 years old, thought I could retire on the money that I had saved, and so I invested this $15,000 in my company. And that was all the money I ever put into the company. I did borrow money. I don't know if I've told this story before, but I'll do it briefly. I borrowed it in a special way. I borrowed on the basis of paying everybody back 10% of the revenue of the company until I had paid them back four times what they put in. And it didn't matter whether the company was profitable or not. I was going to have to pay them 10% of the revenue. So I did that, and it didn't take too many years to pay them off, and most of them said, "Do you have any more deals like that?" But no, I didn't actually. But I was happy for them, and I put in $100,000. I loaned the company $100,000 and raised $200,000 more to do it. So it was funded through a combination of the $15,000 investment plus borrowing a few hundred thousand dollars. And then the company did grow. And I don't know how to tell people really how to do that, except I did get some good help. I found a guy in San Francisco who was in public relations, and he seemed to think that we had an interesting story to tell, and I joined him in New York, and he took me around and introduced me to people at Money Magazine and Forbes and a whole bunch of those financial publications. And those things eventually did, in fact, pay off. While I was in New York, a fellow who was a market timer, he's experienced, he was well known. His name is Jerry Appel. And I called Jerry and asked if he would meet with me back there, that I wanted to start a business and help others with market timing, and wondered if he could act as a mentor to me. And he didn't know who I was. I was not in the business. I was trying to get into the business to help others. And doggone if he didn't say yes. I went back there, and he gave me hours of his time. He came into New York City from outside of it. I don't remember where now. That changed my life. How would I know that I'd be able to get somebody to give me that guidance? And the story goes on and on, getting on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser. That was just happened to come because I had my clients out of the market when the market collapsed in 87. And so even though I didn't call that crash, I was out of it when it happened because of the automated systems that I was using to do the market timing. And some of the people I hired, my son, for example, my company would not have grown and been as successful as it was. And by the way, still is without me since 2012. They're doing just fine. I think they're 50% higher now in terms of money under management than when I left. Of course, a bull market helps. We all know that. But I trusted my son that he did not have a long history in being a manager, but I trust him, and I trust his intuition about how to treat people, and he's organized. I am not an organizational kind of person. I am not a good manager. In fact, if I hadn't had the good fortune of meeting the talented people that I worked with, I would never have developed into the company it was. But it did. Dennis Tilley hired him in 2000 to come in, and he just did amazing stuff with our hedge fund. I think I did mention recently that in the period of 2000 through 2009, while the S&P 500 was losing almost 1% a year, Dennis managed the hedge fund, and it made over 18% a year during that decade. After fees, by the way, and I also mentioned that in the last 10 years, while the S&P was making 12, the fund made 6% a year. So nobody knows how to make money every year or in every decade, but Dennis is one of the smartest people I know when it comes to the whole area of market timing. So, I mean, this is just a start of the people who joined us and built the company. And I don't know how to recreate that. But here's the interesting thing about this rate of return. Most of us have a difficult time figuring out what rate of return we've achieved. I ask people all the time, how have you done? What compound, what rate of return have you had on your portfolio? Most people really don't have any idea. Now, in some cases, it's more difficult than others to know how you did because maybe you were in and out of investments and so you don't, it's not easy to track how you did. You certainly don't know how you would have done had you just kept your money in the stocks that you got out of, because people don't keep track of that kind of thing. They also don't keep track if they get dividends. Do they reinvest the dividends? Because that's part of the earnings. And at some level, you could say that your performance over a lifetime, if you're somebody who trades actively, or I don't mean day trades, but is not a pure buy and holder, your whole life's return could be based on the last trade, the last purchase. I think I've talked about a couple, the wife had nothing to do with it, I don't think, but the husband, as he was nearing retirement, took everything he could get his hands on, including his kids' IRAs and his retirement account, and put it into a company that went bankrupt, that had already been bankrupt before, had come out of bankruptcy, and then went back in. And so his rate of return, whatever it was, up until the point that he did that, might have been 10% a year for all I know. But at the end, his return was nothing. He lost money over his lifetime. Now, that's complicated, too, because if he was living off of some of that money as he went along, that's part of the return that sometimes gets lost. As a matter of fact, when I look at the return from the company I started, my income, my salary, that is not a return on the investment. I got paid a reasonable salary. I also, because I was a shareholder, and it was a sub-S corporation, I then got the income from the business, had to pay tax on it. But I did not track what I did with that income from that sub-S. You see, if I'd had that money in a mutual fund, and I reinvested it in the mutual fund at the end of 30 years, and that's what I'm talking about with my $15,000 investment, at the end of 30 years, you know how much you made. Now, only, of course, if you're in an IRA or something where there are no taxable events, but you can really see what you made inside of a mutual fund. But for the rest of us who may, for example, take that money and pay bills, take that money and go on a trip, take that money and do something, you know, pay for kids' education, but you could also reinvest it, in which case the return is going to go up. I mean, you're going to see the outcome of that return if you leave it all in there. So in trying to figure out what I actually made on the investment over 30 years was a matter of what the company sold for. That was the easy part. I could see what that was, you know, $15,000 in, you sell it for X. But you see, all those distributions that I got, they are like capital gains or dividends to a mutual fund owner, because I didn't get that because of the work I did. I got that because of the investment I made, and that's the way it is for big businesses or small businesses, particularly, you know, for the owners. Now, to tell the rest of the story, to be fair, I gave away over half of the company to others. And so when I talk about making a 30% compound rate of return, I didn't pocket all that money. that money has ended up in other people's pockets. In fact, it's a question I've asked myself. Would I have been that generous with the people I gave it to if I had known it was going to be as successful as it became? Because it was not a business that was started to be big. It was a business that was started to be fun. And by golly, it got big and it was fun. And it still is. But it is difficult for people to know how they've done. I think that the typical response I get from people is, "I've done well. I'm meeting my needs." They don't want to talk about lower expenses at Vanguard. They don't want to talk about more diversification. They have achieved the ultimate goal of most people, and that is peace of mind with a good enough piece of the action that you meet your needs. Now, every once in a while, I meet people who it didn't turn out that way. And then I'm not going to say, "Well, had you put your money in low cost, no load mutual funds, would you maybe have made it?" It's a little forward. And but the bottom line is that in fact, to show you how forgiving people are, I've had people write to me and say, "Thank you for advice. I set up my account using the ultimate buy and hold strategy. I've got my big, my small, my value, my growth, my U.S., my international, my REITs, my emerging markets. But I know how much you've made over the last 10 years compared to what you would have made had you been in Amazon or just the S&P 500. But these are people who, like so many of us, want to do this in a way that we can get a decent return. And evidently they got a decent return, enough that they say, "Thank you, and I feel like I've really done well." Well, as I've said a million times, or maybe 1,000, there is no risk in the past. We always know what we should have done. But yes, that $15,000 investment that compounded at 30%, something over 30%, because I didn't track the value of what the money went to that I got out of the company. That, by the way, I mean, I've had lots of bad things happen to me in my life that meant that I ended up with less than I could have had I had not had those bad things happen. And, for example, divorce, one of the biggest bear markets of all, not only financially, but emotionally. So I think a 30% compound rate of return for a business that is started with a minimal amount of money and has the ability to grow to be very large. It's an interesting business, the money management business. If you think about it, all of the inventory you have belongs to somebody else. I've been in a business. I've owned a business that had inventory. And so that inventory was at risk for me, as opposed to the inventory in the money management business is the risk of the investor themselves. And yes, it is true. You're not making very much of what that money might make or that money might be. But the bottom line is it's a really good business if you want to start with nothing and work your tail off and then get really lucky. Because the other part that's a reality, not only for you as an investor, but for the money management firms who had the good fortune of being in the business during periods of time that the market went up and was up a lot. But it's not like I can do anything to make the market go up. I can't. I can't do anything. The market makes you the money you make. A good advisor, not newsletter writer, a good advisor knows how to hold your hand, or they should, and if they don't, then they're not a good advisor, to keep you on track, or to make sure in the first place you didn't get overcommitted to risk, so that when the risk of that higher risk investment showed up, you were surprised. You didn't realize you were taking all that risk. Well, a good advisor would tell you before you lose money how much money you're likely to lose. Well, enough of that for right now. Let me move on and take some emails from the listeners. And here's one. Says he's a former broadcast print journalist, now working in retirement and in spending time on investing, but can't seem to avoid proofreading, which I used to do a lot of. There seems to have been a numerical typo in your otherwise fine piece on investment compounding over the years. Then he goes on to note that over a 30-year period, the investment had grown to $689,000, but then 10 years later, at the end of 2009, it was worth $649,000. And he puts in parens, gulp. Well, turns out that that's what happened. As a matter of fact, if you look at the distribution tables, taking out $30,000 a year at the beginning of the period, 1970, by the time you get to 1999, you will have almost $16 million in the account, and you'll be taking out, this is with a inflation adjustment as real time, you'd be taking out almost $131,000 starting with $30,000. $30,000 in 1970 to replicate that took $131,000 in 1999. And that's something young people today, they don't know whether they're going to face some outrageous inflation later in their life. And the, you know, the worst case is when that happens in their when they're in retirement and unwilling to take any risk. Anyhow, let me then go 10 years forward to 2009. That almost $16 million goes down to about a little less than $13 million. So that was because you were, and this is out of the S&P 500, 100% in stocks. By the way, if this gentleman had just gone over a few rows, let's say to the 50-50 strategy, he would have seen that at the end of 1999, he would have a little over $9 million. But by 2009, because he had the fixed income in the portfolio, he would end up with about $10.5 million. In other words, he actually, the value went up in the portfolio because of the defense that was there with the fixed income. So if he had just looked at some other rows, he would have noticed that there was a substantial difference if you had some defense along with the offense. And I don't want to bore you with too many numbers, but I think this is a big one. Remember we said at the end of 1999 that the S&P 500, taking out 30,000 or 3% of the original amount, had gotten up to almost 16 million? If you took out 4%, 40,000 to start, and adjusted for inflation, by the end of 1999, you'd have about 6 million, not 16 million, but 6 million in the table where you start with a million, take out 40,000 instead of 30. So you had $300,000 more that you took out. And that $300,000 more that you took out, 30 years, you took out $10,000 more plus inflation, would have drained the pool that you'd be down to $6 million instead of $16 million. So there are all sorts of what appear to be relatively small differences that can have a huge impact. Now, I'm not sure whether this will be a duplicate of one that I handled in the last few podcasts, but here Russell asked the question about using the ultimate buy and hold strategy and not using any international, just to do it with the U.S. asset classes. We will, by the way, in the coming weeks, we will show the ultimate buy and hold where all you use are the U.S. asset classes. Now, we're not going to use REITs. We could use REITs, but the returns, we don't have returns going back to 1970, and we're going to do the same period from 1970 to 2019. We're going to be doing that with the 10 different equity asset classes, and we'll do it with the 4 equity asset classes just to compare that difference in asset allocation, because you're going to go from 10 equity asset classes of 10% each to 4 equity asset classes of 25% each. And we'll do it in that same way that we do the longer one. We'll start with 100% of the money in the S&P 500, and then we start adding the other 3 equity asset classes, 25% each. So the second portfolio will be 75% S&P 500, 25% large cap value. Then the next portfolio will be 50% S&P 500, 25% large cap value, and large cap, small cap blend. And then finally, 25% in the S&P and 25% each in large value, small blend, and small value. And that ought to give you some idea, Russell, how that's going to look generally. I mean, it's always generally anyhow, because we can't replicate the past regardless what it was. Here's an email from Jim. I'm 23 and just signing up for my company's 401k plan. They have an S&P 500 and an actively managed small cap value, but no target date fund. They also have an international developed market fund. By the way, that's would be large cap blend internationally as an asset class. And what he's trying to do, he'd like to do the 2 funds for life, but there is no target date fund. 23 years old. Well, what you're going to have to do, Jim, is you're going to have to multiply your age by 1.5. Now, let's just call that, for the sake of discussion, 35, or round to 35. Now, if you're going to try to replicate the target date fund, and you've got the S&P 500, and you've got the international target date fund, you would end up putting 25%, basically 75%, of the part that's going to be in a look-alike of the target date fund. So you'd have 25% in the S&P 500 and 10% in the large cap international blend, and then the balance of 65% in small cap value. Now, I'm sorry, it's not an indexed fund for the small cap value, but the small cap value premium is large enough that even with the higher expense ratio, you should still add value with that small cap value fund in the portfolio. Now, here's what you've got. You've got a little more work, but you are going to eliminate all fixed income at your age. There will be no fixed income, and I think that's the way it should be. You probably should be that way until you're 40. And at 23, you're probably going to have three or four more jobs, which means you're going to be transferring what you've got, hopefully, into a 401k somewhere where you are going to have access to the target date funds and hopefully lower cost indexed funds. Here's another email from Hiram. I am sorry to pepper you with a second question. Oh, yes, I remember you, Hiram. I know that you are very busy. You know something? It is easy for me to take a question when the question is concise. And I know that I'm not always so concise. So I understand the idea that some people want to write more than others. But it just emotionally makes it easier for me when I see relatively short questions. But my wife and I are saving up for a house down payment. The goal is to purchase something in 2 to 3 years. After reading your article, 7 Things You Should Know About Cash, I was thinking of putting the funds in a Fidelity Short-Term Treasury Bond Index Fund. And that's F as in Frank. F is in Fidelity, actually. U, M is in Mother, B is in Boy, X, F-U-M-B-X. And that short-term bond fund is paying about 1.65%. You can, I'm sure, write checks against it if you need to. It is low risk, but here's the other possibility. I took a look over at bankrate.com. And I saw that you could put in a money market account at Citibank. You could put, but I don't know how much your down payment is, but you would probably qualify for the 1.85% money market or money account rate. Ally Bank, if you've got a $5,000 minimum, can do a 1-year CD. You said you were going to need this probably in 2 or 3 years. So if you really don't need it for 2 or 3 years, their rate is 2% there. If you wanted to cash out early, there's a penalty of 60 days of interest. So you might come out ahead with less volatility if you went with the Citibank money market or the relatively short-term Ally Bank CD at 2%. This is not a response to an email, but it is from an article that I just read this weekend. I subscribe to the BBC.com, the essential list, they call it, and they pick out their, I think it's 5 best stories for the week. They're not the kinds of things you would normally read, but I think how different investors are and how if you don't understand their biases, their fears, their desires, you may not know the right thing for them. I mean, that's why you can't have a cookie cutter approach for every investor. Obviously, we're trying to do that as a newsletter / podcast service to be able to give you portfolios that will fit you, but without that conversation. But I was struck by the differences of societies. And of course, there's going to be reasons why this is so. But in a study comparing dropped phones and wallets, where people have dropped them, lost them, left them somewhere in New York and Tokyo. 88% of phones that are lost in Tokyo are handed into the police. 88% compared to 6% of the ones lost in New York. And in the wallets, lost wallets, 80% of Tokyo wallets were handed in compared to 10% in New York. Now, one of the reasons is that they have an abundance of police stations that in Japan that make it easier for people to be able to hand them in. But we just have to remember what different worlds people can come from. Do we see that in our politics? I mean, it is. These are worlds apart of beliefs and whatever kinds of characteristics you want to focus on. Sometimes it seems like there's little that's similar between the two sides. And here we have this difference between the response to finding something. In fact, what really brought it to mind to me was today my wife and I went out walking. We went a different way. And we were down a couple blocks from our house, and somebody, and I haven't, by the way, walked that way for months. Somebody somewhere found my ski hat, my knit hat that I wore when we were having snow here. And I didn't walk down there when we had snow, but they had found it, and it ended up on a mailbox in front of one of the houses down there. And it's a beautiful knit hat, and it was so good. I felt like I was living in Japan. I want to close this podcast with three pieces out of the service that I get called By the Numbers. I think there are some interesting lessons here. The first one is about the USA's GDP growth for 2019. It is believed that it will be at least 3% for last year. And it's interesting to note that at the end of that record streak of 13 consecutive years of sub 3% growth, 13 years, that the stock market has compounded the S&P 500 at 7.8%. Now, that period includes 2007, 2008, and the early part of 2009. The next longest streak in our history of sub 3% growth are the 4 years from 1930 to 1933. And the market then compounded at a negative 11.9% for those 4 years. Of course, the growth was not as the growth for the 13 consecutive years were certainly much better than those terrible 4 years from 30 to 33 during the Depression. But I had not known when the last long period of sub 3% growth had been. Second one is about the Omaha School Employees Retirement System Pension Plan has got a $771 million shortfall in its funding efforts as of January 2019. A proposal that is now being considered would impact all retirees and current employees by lowering annual cost of living adjustments in 2024 and reducing pensions for new hires made after July 1st, 2021. And I mention this because I'm going to be talking to a group of graduating seniors at Western in June, and I don't want to make it a downer, but these young people, there are a lot of things, a lot of headwinds that they're sailing into here, because many people are going to see if they do have pensions, those will be reduced. Fewer pensions will be offered. Social Security is not likely to maintain the rates that it pays out right now. It might, but it wouldn't be surprising. And of course, we have no idea what kinds of returns investments will make. We do know the S&P 500 over the last 20 years has compounded at about 6%. Does that tell us anything about the future? Well, we certainly hope not. But there are headwinds. And I happened to see the show, the movie last night about a town, a documentary entitled American Factory. And it tells the story about a glass factory in Ohio that was closed. I think it was a General Motors plant. It was closed, and a Chinese company bought it, and they updated it and put in a lot of new automated equipment that made it possible to do the work with fewer people. But beyond that, the people who were working in the plant were being paid, I think, less than half of what they had made before. In fact, there was one fellow who said his daughter does pedicures for a living and makes over $40,000, and he makes $28,000 working in the plant. So that's another headwind. We are not only in competition with the Chinese in China, but we're also in competition with the Chinese in the United States. I'm talking about this firm was bringing people from China to work in the factory here for 2-year contracts, and I think being paid a lot less than the U.S. employees. And this is not a political statement, although I don't know what involvement the Obamas had in making the film. They were interviewed at the end of it, but it was not. I don't think it was a political film so much as it was the plight of the Midwest in many areas and how things change. In fact, I think at the end of the movie, they had a number for how many people are going to have to be globally going to have to learn to do something new. I think about 378 million people, if I remember the number. I think the last item here from by the numbers that's more fun is the story about the 1968 Ford Mustang Bullitt GT, driven by actor Steve McQueen in the 1968 movie Bullitt. It was purchased by a private investor for $3.4 million. It was originally in 1974 purchased for $3,500 in a private sale. The fellow that bought it originally, Robert Keeman's son, Sean, sold the car at auction in Florida on the 10th of January. The annual pre-tax gain for the car was 16.1% over the entire 46-year holding period. Now, that's a very good return. It's a good return when you compare it to the S&P 500 of 10.7%, or the total market index of 10.9%. What is interesting is when people report the gain of something, I suspect that they did not include the percentage that the auctioneer was paid, although maybe that's paid, I don't know, maybe it's paid by the buyer. But the car was probably in storage for 46 years. The car was undoubtedly insured for 46 years. And we also don't know what they put into it to maintain it. Now, when you see the return of a mutual fund, it is after all expenses, not, by the way, the load you might pay to get in. that is not reflected in the long-term or the short-term returns at Morningstar. But everything else, all the expenses, all the costs of commissions and the spread between the bid and ask when they trade, etc., all those things are reflected when you see that 10.7 or 10.9% return. So I don't know how far down that 16.1 might come. I did, just out of curiosity, take a look at what the small cap value index, according to DFA, had done for that 46-year period, and it was a little over 16.5%. And by the way, and that's without management expenses. And as we know, you can get a fund at Fidelity small cap value that charges 0.05%. So that is a heck of a return for a car. I'm not certainly not suggesting that they probably didn't have a whale of a lot of fun with that car and a lot of pride in owning that car. But once again, you got to dig deep. It's just like trying to figure out what I made on my investment. It's not easy because we don't keep track of what goes into something and what do we do with the stuff that comes out. Anyway, I hope something of today will you found of interest, and I hope you're working on your lists of people to send the new book to when it comes out in a few months, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week. Maybe, just maybe, we'll have the updated information on the ultimate buy and hold table that we have not updated since 2018. So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.